Hello, and welcome to the Grand Cinema Hotel, a podcast hosted by two friends who love cinema. Tonight, you'll be staying in room 187, The Darjeeling Limited, the fifth film by Wes Anderson. So go ahead, get comfortable, and throw on that Do Not Disturb sign as we get back to our Wes Anderthon with The Darjeeling Limited.
I think we have a chance to make this kind of a life-changing experience, and I think we need it.
I want us to become brothers again like we used to be.
You're the two most important people in the world to me.
This is incredible!
Why haven't we spoken in a year?
Because we don't trust each other.
Is that my belt? Can I borrow it?
Going on, all my brothers, and thank you for checking back in. I'm your host Gus, and as always, I'm with my co-host Alvaro.
What's up, guys?
Before we get started, make sure you subscribe if you're listening on YouTube. Give us a follow, drop a comment, share the thing, you know, or whatever podcast app you prefer. Honestly, just drop us a follow or any way you can support. It helps out immensely, and we really appreciate it. The Anderthon rolls on. It continues. We're back. It was a nice change of pace to break it up a little bit. I think it felt nice, at least, to do a couple of other films in between.
It's just, sorry. It's just something we've talked about doing. So it's kind of, just kind of cool to always be like, regardless of what's going on, there's certain directors that we always are thinking about, and Wes Anderson is one of those.
Yeah, and I mean, the movies that we covered in the time between Steve Zissou and this movie, The Darjeeling Limited, very different movies.
Yeah,
they couldn't be any more different, the three of them, right? Don't Look Now, Killers of the Flower Moon, When Evil Lurks. But I thought, you know, it was a pretty strong month, and it was really nice to do those. You know, like, I wouldn't have wanted to wait until this was over to get to those. But yeah. I also do enjoy hopping back into this world. You know, it's a nice sense of familiarity.
Yeah, when Evil Lurks video around Thanksgiving would have felt weird, but people could have seen it, right?
I guess the one positive. I mean, it might have been more algorithmically friendly.
Maybe I did think, you know, it was good to release them though in October.
Hey, When Evil Lurks got a lot of good feedback, a lot of comments, you know, a lot of people teaching us about the culture a little more, you know. Bring up. I thought that was cool.
Probably
the videos and the podcast, a lot of good reception, I'd say. Killers of the Flower Moon, I'm happy with how that episode is doing. And I mean, When Evil Lurks, yes, I feel like that one got a lot of traction with our actual listeners, like, engaging. So thank you if you are one of the people who went ahead and dropped a comment, because that's one of the things, like, I don't want to put it on the audience and be like, you guys don't engage enough, but it's like, I do want people to tell us if we're wrong or teach us something, you know, like, it's two-way street.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the times, like, we are basing it on our memory, you know, and I do think there's people, like, especially a bit more than me, that have better memory about certain aspects that I think either could counter our points or go in our favor. And either way, I do want to listen to them, because maybe I misunderstood the material, which I've never thought that I couldn't, you know. I definitely am open to, maybe I didn't understand this movie, you know.
Oh shit, that didn't happen at all in this
movie. Exactly. Yeah. Oh damn, that was my dream, you know.
So. Podcasting is a stream of conscious, and it sometimes doesn't make sense, you know. It's not the most meticulous form of broadcasting, you know. It's an open conversation, so it is nice to actually open up that conversation to the audience and to have them partake as well, you know. But transitioning into the movie, The Darjeeling Limited, the fifth film by Wes Anderson. Like we said, it was nice. It's nice to be back in the world. Alvaro, first time, correct?
Yeah.
Are you close to checking off the list? I know this is one of them, right?
This is one of the ones I haven't seen. The next one I have seen, which I'm excited for. Getting ahead of myself, way ahead of myself. But this is one of them. Still missing Moonrise Kingdom and there's one more, right? There's one more I haven't
seen. But I mean, you've seen the first five now. and you've seen correct. Everything past Grand Budapest. So yeah, you got you have Moonrise Kingdom.
I think that's the last one. Yeah,
because you've seen Isle of Dogs, you've seen Grand Budapest, you've seen Asteroid City, you've seen The French Dispatch.
I for some reason thought there was one in between here that I was missing, but yeah, I only have one more.
Nice. This for me had checked it off, except for the new short films that have come out yet. I've yet to watch those. As much as I wanted to see them when they came out, because I didn't see them in the theater, I obviously don't feel like I really missed out by not watching it the day it came out on Netflix, you know? And also I didn't want to watch them for the first time and then do the podcast on the months later. And you know, I wanted to kind of have that fresh feeling. So I've been saving them. I have a little scheme going on with Netflix at the moment.
Yeah.
I won't say too much, you know, but I'm waiting for all of the movies I want to see to come out, and then I'm going to free trial it.
Yeah. New email.
Yeah, you know, new email, exactly. But back to Wes Anderson. Like we said, the fifth film, Wes Anderson check-in. We talked about before previously his living situation, right? And this is finally when the move to Paris happens and he's relocated. And since then, he's never moved back to the United States. And I do think this movie kind of reflects that sensibility a little bit. But I do think it's interesting because the movies that do come after this, they are very different, you know? Like, I feel like this is the last one like this. Kind of in the, like, we talked about the midpoint career last time being Steve Zissou. I think the Darjeeling Limited is the cutoff between, like, his last film that really takes place in reality.
I've heard it be called The Bridge.
Yeah, because, I mean, as much as we love the dollhouse storybook aesthetic, this movie takes place firmly in the real world, you mm-hmm. know, in a real country, on location, on an actual train. So this, as much as I love that other stuff, this one, you know, I've seen the opinion that it's the most human of his movies because of those reasons, you know. It's only got three main characters, and it really, they are the focus, you know. Like, Angelica Houston is there, yes, but it is, more than any of his other films, it really is just about these three people. I mean, Rushmore, Royal Tenenbaums, Steve Zissou. I wouldn't say they're exactly all ensembles, but every character has a part to play in this movie, and in those movies, but in Darjeeling, it is these three brothers, you know. And It lives and dies with them and their relationship. This is a movie I'm very fond of, especially upon my rewatch. For me, I think this is either second or third time, because this was one for me where I did have to like check it off my list. I'm like, I haven't seen this one yet, you know? It's probably one of my faves too. You know, I was compiling the top five list, or like the list of them in order, and yeah, this movie really does it for me. I don't want to say I think it's like technically the best movie, I'm saying in a technical sense or in like a formal sense or anything like that, but it just speaks to me in a way that like some of the other ones don't. And I kind of hold it in a special place for it because it does, like you said, that I think the fact that it bridges the two types of movies that he makes is why I find it so appealing to me.
Yeah, this is the first time I watched it. I ended up feeling like this is, if you asked Wes to make Bottle Rocket again, he would have made it more like this. I mean, obviously, it would have been the different background. I think the background here helps a lot with what he ended up turning into, making the dollhouse scenes and like kind of focusing on that. So I think like the use of different culture here kind of made him like go outside of his box and be able to learn how to do that stuff. I think this movie shows that a lot, but I did feel almost like because it reminded me of Bottle Rocket too. I in similar ways, because I felt like it was all over the place. What was I going to say? I think it reminded me of a lot of like in Bottle Rocket, right? It's technically two of them, but it's three because the maid is there, right? A lot of the time, that storyline takes a lot of Bottle Rocket.
Yeah, and then there's the third friend. I can't remember what his name is at the moment. Oh, yeah, but the third friend that they use just because he has a car.
Yeah, so then I did end up feeling, because Adrian Brody's first introduced here, and I think used in almost every movie after this, besides Moonrise Kingdom, correct?
I'm sorry, what?
Adrian Brody is first brought here.
And this is his first one, and he's in pretty much all of them after this.
Besides Moonrise Kingdom, right?
Yeah. I would have to double check on Isle of Dogs.
Yeah.
Currently that's my least favorite Wes Anderson movie. That's the one I've only seen once, and that voice cast has so many people in it, I don't even know if he is one of them.
Yeah, but I think he may.
But, I mean, he's in Asteroid City, he's in The French Dispatch, he's in Grand Budapest, he's in this, and he's fantastic in all of them. I think he's he's a great addition to his cast. I think that he really like jives with the style of movies and dialogue that Wes creates.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, is that there's the bridge here, as I see it. He picks up Adrian Brody and almost drops Owen Wilson. You know, and they're in stuff not as much later. You know what I mean? Like, this right before this bridge, Owen Wilson is very prevalent in his work. Adrian Brody is not. And I think later it's Adrian Brody is. And not that they do the same thing to him, but And then I also, it's interesting because I like Rushmore so much that we get Schwartzman here. Kind of more seasoned, you know?
This is 10 years since Rushmore. So that's another interesting point about about this movie, is that it's not only is it a bridge point and a fifth film, it's also the 10th year of his career. So that is it almost is when you become an expert, you know, it's like you do something for 10 years and then you can call yourself an expert. Yeah. So I do think that this movie has a lot going for it because of that as well. Like, just the experience and also making the movie in a different way that they hadn't before. You know, Steve Zissou was the most expensive one up until that point. And yes, they do have a lot of these crazy sets and this big boat, and they're out on the open water and they're going to these islands and stuff like that. But this one, while it does have a lot smaller of a budget, I mean, they're on this train, right? And this, we talked about this in the Asteroid City episode, because it's a thing he still does to this day, but it's like no trailers, no makeup. It's like the actors are in charge of their own wardrobe. You know, it's like I don't know what you would call it really, right? But it's like a different type of filmmaking. It's like, okay, I'm established now and I know what I want to do, and I'm going to ask these actors to do something that maybe another director or a more run-of-the-mill studio film is not going to ask them to do. And like, an interesting aspect in one of the interviews I watched was like, yeah, like if you missed the call and you didn't make it to set, there's a good chance that the set and the movie took off and you were stuck in the town that we were in the night before or whatever, and now the train's moving and you're not here. So that is a very interesting, like, we've talked about his like troop of people, you know, almost like a traveling circus, and I think this is where it really starts.
Yeah,
like I said, this movie really does just add a lot to his overall filmography, I would say, because I do think he's also kind of repeating some of the things that we did see in Bottle Rocket. Like, Owen Wilson's character in Bottle Rocket is not that different than his character in this movie as well. You know, he's overbearing, the meticulous planning, the way he thinks that he can control the other people around him in ways that are positive for them. You know, it's not like he sees, there's the main thing I wanted to bring up is like, there's a point in this movie that's brought up multiple times of Owen Wilson ordering Adrian Brody's food for him. And it becomes a point of annoyance. And it's like, yeah, you or me would feel the same way if, I don't know, if we were doing it to each other, right?
Right,
yeah. Okay. You know, Alvaro wants a 10 piece nugget from Chick-fil-A and he doesn't want ranch, you know? And it's like, but if the twist on that is that he's right most of the time. Like, he does know what is good for his brother, and that is also kind of annoying as well, you know, where it's like in Bottle Rocket he comes to the realization that he doesn't know what's good for everybody, but here it comes with this like brotherly love twist, and you see it also comes from the mother too, and it's like, no, I do know what's best for you, and I'm sorry if that is annoying, you know, but it's like it comes from a place of love. And it's not so, it's like I think that's what makes this familial bond more endearing to me, more than like just two people in Bottle Rocket. It's like, I know they're friends and stuff, but there is a bond here because they're brothers that they're going to be inherently more connected than just two people who are friends, you know?
Yeah, I do think that's, even though this is, I guess so far on the lower side for me of his, I still like the dynamic of the brotherhood like almost near the top of what how he dissected it. You know what I mean?
I get you. It's like, okay, I saw, and I don't want to get into ratings too much because they're all, who really cares at the end of the day, right? It's like, but I gave this a 4.5 and you gave this a 3.5. But even when I knew, even when I saw that you gave it a 3.5, I was like, I know he still likes this movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah, there's still
so many of the good things in here about all of his movies, right? Yeah, it's like, hey, I'm a sucker for the relationship between the brothers because they do remind me of the Tenenbaums, or I don't know. I would say the Tenenbaums, because after this, there isn't too many more family-oriented films. But it's like those two films are kind of reflective of each other. And we've talked about this before as well, too. It's like he is reflective of himself. And that was a big point of criticism during this movie, too. You know, I watched, he used to go on Charlie Rose a lot. Like that was where he would go for every movie. There's an interview with Charlie Rose. So I've been watching these interviews, and Charlie Rose asked him about the, like, what do you say about people who call you repetitive and quirky and all surface level and stuff like that, right? And even since back in the day, 2007, I believe this movie is, he's still defending the idea of, like, if in my gut, it's telling me to make the movie this way, well, I have to do it. And whether it's repetitive or not, go ahead, say I make the same movie over and over again, but it's the story that I feel compelled to tell.
Yeah.
And I don't really see that as a criticism or anything. I mean, obviously not. We're doing all these episodes about him, right? But then he also said about the quirkiness is like, sure, these people are quirky and, okay, yeah, they're a little out there and weird. But all of these characters are amalgamations of people I have met and known. And how is it so weird if these people exist?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And maybe he is more attracted to the awkward weirdos of the world, but they're real people, you know? And it's like, I know people like to kind of give him some crap about his characters and his worlds and things like that. It's like, it's so fantastical and non-real, but I think this movie also really cements the point that it's like, no, I'm telling a deeply emotional story about three brothers who are dealing with loss and abandonment and their trust issues and trying to work it all out in a time when they're not really well equipped to do so. You know, it's like they're taking this trip to India, which is a whole other thing. I'm going to kind of get sidetracked here because you brought it up earlier. It's like the choice to use this setting, right? And yeah. I would say it's kind of controversial, you know, because he has been accused once or twice of Orientalism, right? And using Asian people or
Indian people, right?
As background characters, as aesthetic. And I will say, not to defend it too much, I do think that whether he knows it or not, that's kind of like another point of the movie is like, yeah, these dumb white people think they can just go to India and that spiritual place and they're going to solve all their problems. And yes, they do, you know, or, well, it's implied that they do, right? By the end, that, like, okay, things are better than they were before this trip. But it isn't just because they went to India. It's because they accepted things about themselves and they accepted things about their mother and the situations they're in. And, you know, like, okay, like, I do feel that the world is better for me if my brother is in it, you know? And if you can't, if you're not willing to see that in this movie, I don't know if you're really giving it a fair shot, you know?
I'd be like, I also,
like, how can you not see that, right? Because this is not a subtle movie.
I also do disagree, I guess, in this, in just the aspect of this movie, that they're just kind of used as background, or that they're not really given. Because I do think, like, Rita and the love triangle that's going on there, like, there's interesting character dynamics there. They're given the same type of quote-unquote quirkiness that every other character here is given, and they're not given any less of a, like, like, they seem to have more of their stuff together in line, like you said, to be more respectful towards the culture. And, like, I do think whenever he gets the chances here to just use the camera to just show the culture, that's kind of more what it's there for. Like, that's how it's paying respect. And the characters aren't any given into any negative limelight.
I mean, when you watch this movie, is it not obvious why he would choose to make a movie here? It's beautiful.
Yeah, exactly. And like it's Wes Anderson. Like the colors in India are very vivid, you know, those oranges and blues. So
I think that this movie too is very indicative of the type of person that Wes Anderson is. It's like like a deeply intellectual and artistic minded American who wishes they were French and thinks that you can go to India and become a more spiritual person. Like being a white person who's like that, who is interested in exotic cultures, is like, that is Wes Anderson. You know what I mean? And it's almost like it's even more inspired too, but like, you know, the Beatles, when they went to India and then they became involved in all this like psychedelic shit. And I mean, literally it changed the course of George Harrison's life. You know what I mean? Like going to India was a spiritual awakening for him. Or even, you know, when they make fun of it in like Dewey Cox, right? He goes to see the Beatles in India. And like Paul Rudd is playing John great record. But it's like, you know, to the white man's fault. Yes, like they do think that they can go to India or exotic places and fucking, if I go pray in some exotic forest or temple, then that'll be the answer to my problems. And I'm like, sorry, bro, it's not. You know, and it's like, that's another part of this movie. Like, it's another layer that's like, going to this place is not going to fix your problems, you know?
Yeah, I don't, like, again, because I do agree with what you're saying. I don't ever think he's taking anything, like any type of culture, just to have it as a background set. I know, I mean, I've heard that a lot of complaints like that from him, you know, with like, how come there's not any black people in these movies? But I just do think it's based off of what you said. Like, he built, as he was coming up, the people who were around him, and the type of guy that he is, the type of white guy that he is, like all of his friends are white. I don't know what to tell you. You know what I mean? So it's like, it's not like he's just going to pull somebody who he can't work with as well as these actors just because I need to include them. But he does, Jeffrey Wright.
I was going to say, you know, there has been a more concentrated effort.
I think so, yeah.
To cast people Hong of Chow, color, right? And to also not just make them aesthetic pieces, you know, because like, I will say the main offender would probably be Pagoda in the Royal Tenenbaums. He really is just a, oh, look at this exotic dude from India who's my assistant lackey type of guy.
You know what I mean?
Like, but then, as much as I love Pagoda, he's a hilarious character. I think that's he is just aesthetic, you know?
That plays to what you said, though. Like, that's the type of person that the Tenenbaums, like
look at our cool Indian housekeeper.
Yeah, that's who you would expect to, because he's not a good person.
Hey, look, bro, as two non-white people, that is some white people shit to be like, my exotic housekeeper or my exotic driver, or, you know, he's foreign, but he's quite sophisticated. He was a doctor in India.
Yeah, so even though it's like double-sided, right? It's still because you want people to think you're progressive, you will not be a bad person to this person. So, I mean, progressively, it's for your benefit, but I do think it still serves the purpose of the story in his movies.
You know, and like the concentrated effort that I brought up, it's like, if you bring it up and then he does make an effort to correct this, and also, you know, the more he's grown, the more worldly he's become, mm-hmm. I'm not surprised that more different types of people are in his movies, you know, because he's seen the world. So, yeah, the Jeffrey Wrights, the Hong Chows, you know, just... insert here, you know, I'm not gonna go through a list.
I'm just like,
kind of demeaning to be like, let me list every person of color that's ever been in a Wes Anderson movie.
Yeah,
right,
for me it's like, you know Dev Patel is one of them, and like, well,
look, yeah, but it's like, okay, so it's do you want to address the problem, you know what I mean? And then I should just be shamed forever, or do you want to address the problem and I will make an effort to fix
that's
it,
like, cause I,
so what do you want him to do? I just feel guilty about being white, basically.
Like, I do think all recently, like you said, when I thought about it, maybe he got that complaint. I do think it kind of, he's like, damn, he's kind of right.
Now, Jeffrey Wright's the best character in the past two movies he's made.
Yeah, so and that's why I just kind of noted, be like, in everything he's done new, there's been additions of minorities that actually end up kind of taking the show. So I do think he took the criticism.
I don't love the French Dispatch. But Jeffrey Wright's performance in The French Dispatch is one of the best performances in any Wes Anderson movie.
Yeah.
And then the way he's cooking in Asteroid City, yeah. You know, because I saw someone repost the clip the other day and everybody was like, oh, the Margot Robbie scene is the one that really shattered me. It's the one that stood with me the most. And it's like, you've all been posting the wrong scene. And it's the one where Jeffrey Wright is doing the speech in front of the podium. Mm-hmm. Born in the Island, 1945. Blah, 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 blah. Right?
So good.
And I'm like, dude, Jeffrey Wright is Wes Anderson's writing as an actor. You know what I mean? Like, he does it so fucking well. So, yeah. I mean, I do think it's a good thing if this criticism did get to him and he was like, yeah, I should correct these, I guess, wrongs that I've been doing, you know? Like, wow, I never kind of thought about it, you know?
Because in another, like, light to see it, obviously, when this movie was made, we're not talking about like the 1970s or anything. You know, there's a lot of Indian movies people are very aware, but I mean, in mainstream, how much popularity Wes already had in this, nobody was really making a movie with the background in India this way. So I do think it's like he didn't do it for like,
he's inclusive, you know what I mean? Out of love.
Yeah, exactly.
Like the fact that he made the movie here and like, yeah, you know, he could, I'm sure it could be misguided. Your appreciation for a place can also be a little weird and gross, kind of, you know, but I do think that this movie, I don't know. I don't think it's looking down on the people of India. I don't think it's that these people are white saviors. I don't think any of those icky kind of things are going on. It's just, I don't know, bro. What kind of world are we living in? You know, it's like, don't you just hate when white people go on vacation?
Exactly. I mean, this was a while, like you said, this is a complaint from a while ago too. This movie is from,
this is over 10 years old. Yeah, this is like a 16 year old movie now at this point.
Yeah, so that's, this is
before, times were also different, I would say.
This is before he would have actually gotten hit by the woke mob.
I'm caught in the crosshairs of the woke mob.
Yeah.
All right, so let's get into the movie a little bit. You know, the Darjeeling Limited, quick breakdown: three brothers reconnecting a year after their father's funeral, on a spiritual journey through India to try to bond and become closer to each other. But this is all really just a ruse to go visit their mother, who has become a nun in a convent in the Himalayas. And yeah, like that is the plot of the movie, but this movie really is about brotherhood. I would say brotherhood, abandonment, and trust issues, because that is what the bulk of this movie has going for it. It's these conversations between these brothers, but they're not very good at communicating with each other. They hide things from each other. You know, these agreements that is like, it's quite ironic that Owen Wilson is asking for these agreements of total honesty when, you know, his face is a gigantic lie. You know what I mean? That he's carrying throughout the movie. Like I said, I obviously really enjoy this one, but I kind of wanted to ask you a little more, since this was your first time. Like, how did you react to this? Like, 15, 20 minutes in, what was your thought process?
I guess I did end up feeling like, that's how I compared it to Bottle Rocket. I think it's like, I ended up feeling like there's things here that I appreciate from, you know, how far we've gotten here. But I felt like it took a long time for the dynamic of, like the dynamic between the three brothers to really set to me, as much as it would in other movies. And I think it is due to the quote unquote quirkiness of the characters. And, I ended up just finding this funnier than I did more like compelling. And I think at the end, when it really tries to, you know, land that this is just a ruse to visit their mother, it's like, I never felt sad like I did in the Tenenbaums, or I never felt any of the emotions. Like all the other movies, the humor was there, but then at the end, I did end up feeling like these are all troubled characters, which I see that in this movie, because that's, again, I think like the criticism of this movie is like, this does feel like a continuation of those type of characters, but it didn't feel for a long time like I would feel the emotional damage between them three, or like the sadness of this movie. I did end up feeling like the whole time I appreciated that it's very well made, but I thought it was funnier than I did think. Like, it's so at the end when it kind of wants to hit that, you know, last note of like, this was all about this, I was just kind of like, huh, okay. Like, and then 15 minutes in, like, obviously I didn't know that would be the conclusion. 15 minutes in, I did want to see, like, what's the... I kind of did expect, I think, because of Bottle Rocket, that Owen Wilson's character was lying about his face. And then I was like, it would make sense to me in this Wes Anderson movie that it would be because I just wanted to be with my brothers. I didn't know it would be about the mom, right? But I did just assume that, like, based off of how Wes makes these characters with the deadpan humor, usually that ends up helping with me be like them being that way is more emotional, because I'm like, oh, I understand that they're really troubled, you know, because that's why they're like this, because they've been hurt. But for this one, I did kind of feel like it's not like enough, almost not enough of a, like, in the in between for me to establish that they actually have like a really fluid, like, connection, if that makes any sense.
I get you. I mean, they obviously are not very intimate or connected with each other. Like I said earlier, it had been a year to this point, a year at this point since they had seen each other. And then, you know, we get these flashbacks of their father's funeral, and you see that that is a very, well, obviously it's a very emotional day. It's their father's funeral, but a lot of chaos and drama goes into it. A lot of breakdowns, you know, that's a interesting scene that I feel like Wes Anderson kind of has in every movie, is like that weird, awkward, like, guy who's ready to, like, lose his shit, but is not really good at losing his shit, because they're not, like, they're so not used to expressing themselves and how they really feel. And it's like when he rolls out the Porsche and then he, like, threatens the guy in the truck, right? And the brothers have his back and stuff like that. And, like, they're all just digging through the luggage and stuff. Like, there's just a lot going on in this movie where you're like, okay, I could see why these guys don't like each other. And, you know, there's that question in the movie. It's like, could we really be friends in real life, like, if we weren't brothers? And by the end of this movie, I mean, the answer is like a hopeful yes. But then I also still don't know if I buy it that it will carry on past this moment, you know? Like, it will be a moment of reconnection, but more of like a, like, all right, cool, we're good, right? See you later. Not like, oh, great, now we're close again.
Yeah, and like that's why it.
And like, I think that makes it kind of tragic, to be honest, because it's like, yeah, you can still connect again, but it'll never be what it was or what you imagined it was, you know?
And that's like, and that's what I mean at the end of the day, be like, I love how Wes makes movies and what he's saying. So that's why I like this movie. I think it's a good movie. But I did feel like, how you're supposed to feel about the characters at the end, and that usual, like, this humor and these awkward moments ends up becoming happiness, realization, which I think is very realistic. Because, you know, his movies are set up in quote unquote fantasy lands, but I do think what they're saying at the end is very, very human. And I think that's why I like them so much. So, but I did think that was the reason, to me, it does feel like less, I'm not as invested in them as I am in the other ones. And I think it's also just because it tries to fit in, like, the Rita stuff again. I mean, it's funny. That whole thing is funny to me, but I don't know if it necessarily makes me feel like he's, all it really does is show how much of a broken character he is, but I don't think all of them get that.
Yeah. The Rita character and that small love triangle. I mean, I've seen, when I was looking into the stuff about the Orientalism, they're talking about that, like, oh, the exotic brown girl that the white man lusts after, but only at a surface level. He wants to fuck her. He doesn't want to be in love with her and have him be his new girl. You know, like, it isn't a romantic love story. It's a lust for this person, you know, and it's like, that's what they're doing here in India, is like lusting after this, you know, and they really just want to use it. They don't actually want to indulge with it or engage with it in any meaningful way other than just like taking from it, right? And I do kind of feel like she doesn't fit into this movie, like, at all. I don't really think it even has to be there, really. I mean, I can't see why it happens. I get that it's like to show kind of what a emotionally empty character that Jason Schwartzman's character is in this movie, because of the three brothers and the three problems they have and how they handle them, his is to run away. And to also, you know, he writes these fiction stories, quote unquote, that are just, you know, they might as well be diary entries. And he's like, no, it's fictional. Like, he even runs away from the truth of his writing, you know. It's like, no, this is about me and my family. So, you know, it's not lost on me that this movie takes place on a train, and you know, one of the brothers is someone who's constantly trying to escape everything all the time.
And then, like, I do just think, though, he gets kind of like a, it's fine, like I said, it's funny, but he gets a fleshed out kind of like, this is the kind of broken person he is and what he does. And I do think Owen Wilson and Adrian Brody's characters kind of just get it more through conversation. So then I'm kind of like, I don't feel as invested in all three of them equally. I do feel like the story kind of went in different places everywhere a little bit. And it's like, even with Rita's boyfriend, right? Like, there is some, like, you're supposed to kind of feel bad for him too.
Because he got cheated on. And these white people are fucking his shit up.
There's a snake on here because of their fault. And then I'm also like, you're stretching my, who I should be caring about, but you also haven't made me feel like, even though, of course, I know they're broken, then at the end of it, they always do end up making you feel like, I appreciate this, like having a brother, like this is a perfect brother movie, you know, like, but it's, I also felt like, based off of the other movies that I've seen, even in Steve Zissou, I did feel like the bond between the crew and him was, they would die for that man, you know?
Yeah.
And that's kind of like, I think that's when it really lands. The like at the end, the movies always really land to me because I do. And then, you know, fast forward to Asteroid City, I do think Jason Schwartzman, actor in that movie, is conflicted as to why he's doing the play. And then I do feel like you get that through just the character in the play. And that's why it's like, this movie is insane. You know, like, because it's still doing the same exact insane. Thing.
So good. So good.
Same exact thing. But now you're like, throwing three different worlds into it, and it just shows that because he still knows where his end game goal is, he can get me to get, like, to be like, okay, I understand what you're doing here. But for this one, it kind of feels more everywhere.
It's pretty interesting that the movie that has the least amount of characters in it is the one that you feel, I guess it sounds harsh to say, but like, handles it the worst.
Yeah.
How is it the one that has the least amount of characters is the one that feels the most disconnected?
And I think that's, like you said, it's also because it's supposed to feel like that's the point of the movie.
That's where I was going to go with this. So that's a great transition, is like that these brothers. Okay. So it's like, it's obviously complicated to have siblings. I mean, you have a brother. I'm sure you know that it's not as great as it is. I'm sure there's a lot of awful things about it too. Right. I will say though, it's like this movie and the brothers are constantly contradicting themselves, right? So it's like they obviously want to be connected because they wouldn't have agreed to do this trip, right? It's not like he kidnapped them and brought them here. They agreed to go, right? But then he invited them and they show up and everything, but then he steals their passports because he can't trust them, you know?
Well,
and then, go on.
Doesn't he say that, you know, we wouldn't have came if your face wasn't like that, if you didn't tell us your face got like that? I remember him saying that, and like Adrian Brody's character tells that to Owen Wilson. Like,
I don't remember specifically, but there is a moment where it's like, we wouldn't have come. Oh, I think it's when it's about the mom.
Yeah, like if you said if this was the real reason,
we knew that it was going to be to go see her.
So then I do think.
So it's like there's at least an effort to, like, I do want to be your brother. I do want to have this bond more than I actually want to confront my mommy issues that I have, you know. It's like, I was willing to come here to bond with you. Like, now you're trying to make me open a can of worms that none of us really feel like opening. Like, even our mom doesn't feel like opening it, really.
The movie does show throughout the movie that they're broken because of this. I do think that's what I'm saying. Like, it's still good because they're all broken in different ways. One of my favorite things about here is like everything. He's like, you think you have the right dad, like anything that you couldn't break in three pieces, he somehow wants, Owen Wilson wants him to be like, you shouldn't make the decision to be wearing those, or I was his favorite. How did he tell you? I didn't really understand him. You know what
he
I mean?
Told like, me, he's like, he told me as he was bleeding out in the street
that I was his
That's
favorite.
A horrible thing to say.
He's like, I don't know how to react.
He's
to
like,
that.
How am I supposed to feel about that? Like,
oh man. So I like, they're all broken in different ways, you know, but I do think, like you said, Jason Schwartzman's character here does kind of feel more like he's also like, these fools are lame.
Well, he's like, the little bro, obviously, right? So it's like, God, these guys kind of suck, but they are my brothers, so I do want to have them. It's better to have brothers than to not have brothers, right? But then going back to the contradiction thing, it's like complete honesty, total honesty, completely open, trust, right? But then they're fucking high the entire movie, right? Like, even them, they've come here to have this spiritual journey and to try to open up, you know, and get past this and kind of have this awakening and discover themselves, because that's also another theme of Wes Anderson's movie, is constantly the strive for self-discovery. But really, it's just going to India to get high, you know?
And American, like, party boys.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like everything about the movie contradicts itself, you know? It's like... Jason Schwartzman runs away from things, right? Owen Wilson lies about things. Adrian Brody is literally refusing to see the world because he's wearing these glasses that are out of focus for him and blurry. Like, he's even refusing to engage in the world, you know? And it's like Owen Wilson opens up to them. I got into an accident, but then he's withholding a very important truth about the accident. And then Adrian Brody is not wanting to include any of his personal life into this trip. And it's like, so how are you going to be completely honest if you're not actually going to open up about what's happening to you, you know? And then it's like, the only way Jason Schwartzman can do it is through his writing. He refuses to acknowledge that it's even real. No, these are all fictional characters in my story, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, I can't help but feel that's probably a little bit of Wes Anderson peeking through right there. Like, if he wrote that line, it wouldn't surprise me.
It's always with the Schwartzman characters. He's like, I'm going to put myself in him.
Yeah. I mean, getting off the movie a little bit, getting back to the technical aspect, writing. Let's talk about the writing a bit, because this is interesting. Owen Wilson for the first three, Noah Baumbach for Steve Zissou. This fifth one, Jason Schwartzman, Jason Schwartzman's cousin, Roman Coppola, son of, I don't know if you ever heard of him, Francis Ford Coppola. And this is a collaboration that goes on for many years after this. Asteroid City, these three guys, right? It's almost like this movie is just a reflection of them three, this bond as well, because like I said, in the Wes Anderson interviews I watched, the way they wrote this movie, they went to India to write it. They went to Canada. They went to England. You know, they traveled all over the world writing this movie together and also being in separate places too. So I do think it's a deeply personal movie for these three men too, because I do think it's kind of reflective of their own bond with each other as well. Like, these are found brothers, you know, they're the brothers you choose, not the ones you are born with. So I do like that as well, because I feel like each one is putting something into each character. You know, it's like Jason Schwartzman is obviously Jason Schwartzman. Wes Anderson is probably supposed to be Owen Wilson. And then I would say Adrian Brody's probably Roman Coppola. But yeah, I do think that no matter what happens with the writing, that it's like there is still a strong sense of Wes Anderson's overall hands, you know, being included. Like, none of his movies so far have felt like, oh, I could tell someone else wrote this.
Yeah. I could, maybe he, because I mean, he'd end up being the director, and I think maybe he overlooks how certain tropes are done, or what, how we're going to go from scene to scene. But I think character writing and development is based off more of the two other writers, you know, which, you know, that's interesting to say, because I did, you know, I feel like that's where there is a difference, and you're telling me this is where there's a different writer, you know what I mean? So maybe the trio together working for the first time, subconsciously for me, I'm like, I don't know if it worked very well the first time, but they've obviously gotten better. But maybe for me, like, that's where the difference is of what you said. There's the least characters, but I don't feel like they're fleshed out well. Like, well, this is the first movie that he wrote with two other people as opposed to just one. It's like, so what is, how do you divide that work, right?
I mean, between two people, it is easier to be completely synchronized than it is to be with three.
Yeah. And I
because it's only two. And, you know, and it's like, say if me and you have a disagreement on something, it is more easy to, okay, I can see your point and I do think you're right. Or, you know, the other way around, or like, I don't know, man, I'm feeling pretty strongly about this. Can't you see where I'm coming from? But then if there's a third person with a completely different angle than the both of you, be like, now what? None of us are, I can't even get either of us to agree, you know?
Yeah, it's, I think with, at least with writing though too, it's, I don't know how you split up that. I mean, there's various ways to split up the work, but like for a movie, like it's like I write page 1 through 20, but how do you get it to mesh? And I do think, like you said, none of the movies.
Too many cooks in the kitchen sometimes, you know?
No, none of the movies I've ever felt like Wes didn't have control over them. And it's probably has to do with him directing them. But I do think for this one, it makes me, at least it makes me start to think if their writing didn't really work for me for as much as the other ones for this movie, because I'm like, it obviously works very well for me in Asteroid City, and like I said, they've worked, and my favorite one, the Grand Budapest Hotel, is obviously written by them as well.
Let me double check that one to make sure it's written by the three. I don't know
if just two of them, right?
Yeah, or who knows? I don't even know if he wrote that movie by himself, to be honest. I would guess,
because I think it's just
that it would be Roman Coppola, because I know Jason Schwartzman doesn't write on,
yeah, exactly,
all of them. I think that Roman Coppola is the one who becomes like his main second writer. I mean, no, I mean, this one has
a whole different, see, also
three other people. Yeah.
See, so it's interesting to me because I'm like, that's maybe why
Anderson,
certain,
right? Sorry, Wes Anderson. And then you have Hugo Guinness. And Stefan Zweig. I don't even know who, no disrespect, I don't know who those people are. Like, yeah. But that's crazy too. Like, that seems to be the thing that he's the most willing to explore new people, you know, or like new bonds.
And I think
he's always trying to bring in someone new, but I think that there's such a cohesiveness between all of the work that it's hard to even imagine that there's so many different people inputting on this, you know?
And I think that's what I mean. Is like, he must split his work in an interesting way where they do more of the characters, and then he goes in and kind of puts it all together. So
it's interesting. I'd love to be a fly on a wall in these writing rooms, because another thing I will say to the credit of having these different people that he works with for writing, when a movie has three writers, that is usually a bad sign.
Yeah.
It's no, one guy wrote it, then the second guy revised it, and then the third guy was like, both of these,
let's change this. Yeah.
You know,
that's why I find that interesting, because I'm like, again, I do think I love how Wes makes movies, so this movie is so good to me. But now I'm like, huh, every single time I felt different ways about it, has there been different writer, you know? Like, now that I'm going through all of them, it's like, well,
yeah, like this guy Hugo Guinness helped write, well, he helped write the Grand Budapest, and he wrote the French Dispatch, but then the French Dispatch is three different movies. So
which one, right?
And then the Stefan Zweig, original writer, 54 films. And I do believe that the Grand Budapest Hotel is the only Wes Anderson collaboration. I'd have to look into this deeper, because Letterboxd doesn't really give you too many details about like what their role is.
Yeah.
And then I'm not in Grand Budapest research mode right now, so I don't even know if like maybe it's this guy is only included because he wrote a short story that inspired this movie, you know, like there's a lot.
I just brought it up because I was under the assumption this whole time that Roman is in all of them after this, but then I didn't know for the Grand Budapest or Moonrise Kingdom, so I just assumed. But then now that makes it even more, that kind of feel like backs up my argument even more, because it's like, that's the only thing I don't have an issue with. I just feel like it is weakened, even comparable to Steve Zissou, and it shouldn't, because they're brothers. But I felt that way, you know.
You know, maybe. I don't think it's the craziest thing in the world to think either, though, that Noah Baumbach is probably the best writer, like, or the highest, let's say,
peer.
The closest peer he's probably worked with on, like, the same level of, as great as Jason Schwartzman, Owen Wilson, Roman Coppola, they're not directors. Or maybe they have. I don't know. Maybe they've directed a movie. But who Noah Baumbach goes on to become director of Madagascar 3.
Yeah, come on.
Or writer of Madagascar 3. I do think that maybe that's why Steve Zissou holds a place above this movie for you, because it's like, that's the Noah Baumbach touch. And then the interesting thing too, not to get into next week too much, but Noah Baumbach returns for Fantastic Mr. Fox. So there's a Alvaro is currently making the an homage to Ronaldinho, getting ready to feast in the Champions League. Yeah, I'm fucking excited for that one too. I love that movie. Great stuff all around. No notes, no complaints. Kind of burning through this kind of fast now, just to wrap this up. The technical aspects, of course, Robert Yeomans is here to do the camera work. There's a lot of great camera work in this movie. That's another reason why I think this one is still very good. I do think that the camera work helps convey the type of storytelling that we're getting here, because, you know, a lot of research I did into the movie and seeing what other people said, it's like, this is a movie that has a lot to do with communication, right? And that the cinematography in this movie helps to evoke those themes, because this movie is about what's said and then who it's said to, how it's said. You know, there's moments in this movie where Owen Wilson is yelling orders at, but to who? He's just yelling them out loud. Like when his shoe gets jacked, he's like, go get him. But he's not telling them. He's just like saying it out loud, right? And then there's a lot of moments where a message is given, and then the camera whips right to the other thing, and it's like, no, to this person. Like, you need to know that I'm talking to you, you know?
Yeah.
Or how the way that, the way they use the train in this movie. Like, the reason this movie set on a train is quite superficial and just, hey, I like movie trains.
Right? Yeah, I was going to get to
that. Like, that's the thing. Like, they asked Wes Anderson, why? Well, I would love to make a movie in India because it's a place that I'm fascinated by.
I love
trains. I love trains. I love traveling on them. I love the way that I love all things trains. And the tradition in the cinematic language of movie trains specifically. And, you know, whether it be Strangers on a Train or like Silver Bullet with Richard Pryor, Gene Wilder, or even Murder on the Orient Express, it's a very cinematic place. You know, like, it does offer a lot.
Train to Busan, huh?
Yeah, Train to Busan. The train is a great piece of cinematic set piecing.
You know? I think it's, you know, as horror,
it's fanatics, beautiful too.
Yeah, I do think it's always when you make the setting of any of your movies something that is also limiting in its real scope, is that's where you could start to get metaphorical and hypothetical and all of that stuff, is because you're like, you're confined to a train, but you're moving towards something. So what does that symbolize? And I think that works for cinema so much, because like you said, a movie that is based so much on cinematography, it's like these three are in the same room. They should be dealing with the same shit, but they live in completely different, like, you know, if you want to break it down, be like different, parts of the train. Like, they all should, like, they share the same room, but they all go about it different ways.
And then, yeah, and like, even the room too, like, the room is it's an interesting set piece, because it's this small tiny compartment, but then there's a mirror and a window, but then they don't, it's like an optical illusion type room, you know? And it's like, is this a window into their soul, or is it a mirror? Because there's so much going on where you're like, and then like that middle frame that's like the door is like its own framing device too, right? Yeah. So it's just a beautiful movie to look at. And, you know, I'm not the most apt person to speak on cinematography, but it's just, you know it when it hits you, you know, because it like hits your eye in a way where you're like, whoa, like, this doesn't look like anything I've ever seen before. Like, this is what movies look like. This isn't what life looks like, you know?
Well, I think I like how you said, like, the framing of the door, because there's, like, a lot of scenes where it switches in between who's talking, and you only see them talking in their centered frame, and you don't know who they're talking to. But it's also, like,
then that camera whips.
Huh. And it's also, like, just letting you know whatever it is that they're saying. They're almost trauma dumping. And it's highlighting them for you. Be like, this is them trying to deal with their, let me show you what's wrong with them. It's, look, I'm showing you, this is what's wrong with this one person in this movie. Like you said, then you later highlight, this person goes about it this way. Like, you know, he runs away. They don't talk about it. And he literally doesn't want to see the world. Like, all of those things are visually shown to you in, like, the most literal way. And with them,
dumping your baggage. Literally dumping your baggage at the end of the movie.
And they just don't say it. It literally is showing you it, though, like, figuratively showing you it. So I think that's what I mean. It's impressive to me because as much as quote unquote on the nose it can be because it's done through cinematic language, I think it's so on the nose cinematically, but it's not, and isn't that perfect? And like anybody could see, but like he's dropped, like, yeah, baggage. They have baggage.
Yeah.
You know, so like it's making it literally like a book for you. And that's, to me, that's just perfect craftsmanship. It's like, whether it could be boring, sure, because I'm feeding you that, but I think it's perfect craftsmanship and anybody can walk in and get the story.
Yeah. I mean, like you said, it's not your favorite Wes Anderson movie, but you can never deny the craftsmanship, right?
Never.
Or it's like, it just works, right? His world works for us. I will say just a couple of other quick things that I love about this movie. Oh, I want to backtrack for 1 second because you were talking about how they're in the same place, but they're not really connected. One of the funniest moments to me is when they're arguing in the temple and Adrian Brody's like, I'm going to go pray to somebody else. And he just like gets up and goes and randomly leaves. And he's like, fuck you guys.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite moments. Another one I think is a beautiful, touching moment is the stuff with their mother. Angelica Houston makes her third appearance in a Wes Anderson movie. And I did find it, you know, pretty emotional, that moment where none of them can really say what they truly want to say. So they sit there and they express it with just their facial features.
I
love that moment. That's such a tender moment to me. And like, sure, whatever. I'm sure there's detractors. Oh, fucking moment sucked or whatever. You know, every movie has that. But for me, at least, in my personal opinion, that's a deeply moving moment in this movie. And it does give me some kind of moment of satisfaction because the mom... It's a total Wes Anderson moment, right? Where she's like, these people need me. And Jason Schwartz is like, what about us?
Yeah, exactly. Right?
Where she's like, oh, yeah, you guys are my actual kids, but these guys need me. But there's an acceptance of it. And there always is at the end of a Wes Anderson movie. I love my mother. No, my mother is not the best person to me. Like, but I still love my mother.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the reality that I talk about. Like, regardless of where it goes, it always comes back to a very... what a Federico Fellini at the end, a very realistic movie, is conclusion, what it's trying to tell you. Wes Anderson movies get to that same conclusion. That's like when somebody like that tells you, be like, yeah, 8.5 Blows is my favorite movie. You're like, how? Or like, you don't make movies like that, but then you're like, wait, no, he actually does though. Like they go somewhere else, but they always come back to the same thing of like why these realism movies work. And I think when you talk about kind of like him going to Europe and getting that influence, I think that ends up solidifying more of like, you can do all of this and this that you did in America, you know, or learn how to craft like this slick more from outside your culture, but you'll always come back to a conclusion that anybody can relate to. Yeah, I think one of my favorite scenes besides the one that you pointed out too is also when they're kicked out of the train and then they have to spend the night together, like in the desert, right?
Yeah, and let's then, get high.
Yeah, and then just kind of like, that's a, like a real brother moment too.
You Claire know DeLune I mean? Plays and they get high.
And they also, and it's also just like you said, they all carry a flame. It's just like cinematic, you know, it's, that scene does feel to me like it's just kind of like a stunt. It'd be like, look how nice this looks.
Yeah, I mean, those quieter moments in the movie kind of say more than the open dialogue that these characters are having with each other. You know, an interesting point of how the communication is done in this movie that I saw in a video essay about Darjeeling, where the person who made the video said that this was their favorite Wes Anderson movie. It's like these people communicate less and less like two people would if they were in front of each other, and more like a group chat does. And it's like, I kind of raised this, huh? It's like, do you want to read my short story? You know, if you're going to do that, you should do
it.
There's a disconnect. Even when they're in front of each other, even when they're in this train, even when they're kicked off together, it's like they can never truly be connected. And like, that's what they're fighting for. This whole movie is like this small sliver of hope that's like, we could still figure this out. And I do always love that about all of the Wes Anderson movies. It's like, they're not cynical, but they do accept the certain like painful things about life and still choose to like persevere through them. You know what I mean? It's like, I can still make a good life out of this. And nothing embodies that more than Asteroid City, when Jason Schwartzman's like, my mother told me that time heals all wounds, and it's like, and it doesn't, it's just a band-aid. it's like it'll never fix it, but it can help, right? And that has always been the, if you really want to think about what Wes Anderson's work is trying to say, is that, you know, it's like it doesn't heal all wounds, but we can at least try to band-aid it.
Yeah, I think that's like why somebody could say his work is repetitive, because it always kind of comes down to that. But I don't think following, like, after you hear what he says, like, about that's the story I feel like telling, if those are general to, I just feel like it always ends up coming down to those are most stories in human history always kind of come down to those elements. So, like, I do just appreciate that Wes Anderson maybe, yes, addresses the same conclusion, but that he could do it in so many different ways and do it through so many different relationships. He could do it through, you know, a captain and its crew, a talented family, kids that are really smart, brothers that are disconnected. Like, that's just all real relationships people have, whether they're quote-unquote quirky. I do think that's what he's saying. Like, there's people that he's met that are like that. So that, I think he has interesting perspectives and subject matter to make the kind of movies that he does. And we kind of had this discussion outside of the pod today. Like, no one can make movies like him.
Yeah, really. I don't even know if anybody tries to make movies like him. You know, like, the closest artist I can think of that is like blatantly trying to invoke Wes Anderson is Tyler, the Creator, whether it be the style or the visuals. You know, like, there's a visual, I forget what song it is, but he's on a train,
yeah.
You know, in a small tiny compartment. Look up Tyler, the Creator. Like, he's dressed like one of these characters. You know what I mean? Like, so I can't think of the luggage. You know, Tyler, the Creator creates his own luggage now. He became obsessed with luggage, you know. All of this stuff stems from Wes Anderson. So it's like, yeah, there's someone in music who is trying to invoke these same things. But in the world of cinema, I don't know anybody who is, you know, hey, put us on game if you know 3-4 other people who are making Wes Anderson type movies, because I'd love to see him. But I don't know. It's such a unique perspective. And obviously we enjoy it.
I mean, the only whoever cooked up the SNL skit, the horror Wes Anderson.
Yeah, yeah. The midnight.
I forget what it is. That was good.
The midnight coterie of sinister intruders. I think that's what it's called.
But, I mean, even the AI bot has no idea what it's doing when you give them the Wes Anderson prompt. So,
yeah. I mean, final things I'll say. It's like I really do fucking enjoy this movie quite a bit. Fantastic music, fantastic cinematography, fantastic relationship between the three actors. The drip, insane. They might be my favorite dressed Wes Anderson characters. A lot of style inspo in here for me going forward. Of how I would maybe like to dress and present myself. Yeah, I mean, I really like this one. I will say, for me, this is in my top five, but I understand that is because of my own personal biases. I don't actually think it's one of the five best movies he's made, but it's for other reasons that are personal, at least. It holds a very special place to me. Like, I do like this movie more than Steve Zissou, even if I think that Steve Zissou is a more ambitious, exciting filmmaking endeavor. You know, like, yeah, crazier things are happening in that movie, but this one really, it sticks with me, you know?
Yeah, no, I get that.
So, I don't know if you have anything that you really want to make sure that you get out before we wrap up this episode, but I'm pretty good here.
Yeah, no, I guess I would just say, I'm glad that I finally saw this. I do think there's a lot of aspects of this movie that are some of my favorite Wes Anderson, I guess I would just call them subject matter or scenes or jokes. The whole movie isn't necessarily his funniest one that I think. Like, I know I said that it's like funny, but I didn't think like, oh, this is his funniest movie. But I just did think that most of the dry humor here is more prevalent, and I did find that I could see why, because either you like it or you don't. And I did think like some of the deliveries don't hit as well as, I mean, maybe he anticipated, but I still end up really just appreciating this movie. And I am curious just at the end if this is gonna be my second least favorite, which is interesting.
It's funny because it's not like it's a bad movie. It's just like, oh, I like all the other ones.
But I would just have to really, really dislike Moonrise Kingdom for it to be like worse than Bottle Rocket, I think. Like anything, like it have to, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting once we get down to doing like our final rankings and stuff, because a lot of what people really, you know, I'll say Moonrise Kingdom is one of people's favorite movies. It's highly regarded in box office. Criticism of the film is, you know, highly praised. People love this shit on Letterboxd. People love this shit on Twitter. It's become kind of iconic, you know, but it's one of my least favorite Wes Anderson movies, and it has been since the first time I've seen it. So, you know, that'll be interesting to see where we fall on this. And it's like, I still think it's a good movie, but I'm more about that. I feel more about that movie the way you do about this one, you know? I'm like, yeah, it's whatever. It's kind of.
Yeah, exactly.
And Isle of Dogs, too. Like, that one is like a. I don't want to say he's ever made a stinker, but for me, I'm like, this is the closest he's getting to a stinker. So, I mean, it'll be interesting to keep doing it. I'm excited to keep going. You know, there's probably going to be breaks again because there's a lot more really good movies coming out. I know you've seen things like Divinity. That's one I really want to see. We probably won't have time to do all of these, but I would like to at least spend some time talking about like Divinity, Priscilla, Saltburn, you know, what all these movies that are Anatomy of a Fall. It's like, I really want to see all of these, and only so many episodes can get done, but these, you know, it feels good right now.
Yeah, there's a lot. There's
Sicko a lot. Season is coming, huh?
Yeah, there's a lot of fire.
Yeah, so don't be surprised if, I don't know, another month goes by without a Wes Anderson episode, but we'll always be here. We'll always come back to this world that we find very familiar and cozy and warm and welcoming. So that wraps it up for us. Tell us what you think of the Darjeeling Limited, where it falls in your Wes Anderson rankings. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.